At least Job had something to complain about. It's difficult to imagine anybody being quite so badly afflicted as Job was. There are some characters in the pages of Scripture who complain in terms not dissimilar from his own. And if we're disposed to visit rather hardly upon Job's head the very extreme terms in which he speaks here of the circumstances of his coming to the birth, we might bear in mind that a later man, great also in God's sight, spoke in similar terms when he was afflicted, as you will find if you will turn with me to Jeremiah chapter 20. Where Jeremiah is put in prison and grievously afflicted because of speaking the right words of the Lord to a rebellious and impenitent generation. Jeremiah 20, verse 14. Cursed be the day wherein I was born. Let not the day wherein my mother bare me be blessed. Cursed be the man who brought tidings to my father, saying, a man-child is born unto thee, making him very glad. And let that man be as the cities which the Lord overthrew and repented not. Let him hear a cry in the morning, and shouting at noontide, because he slew me not from the womb, and so my mother should have been my grave, and her womb always great with me. Wherefore came I forth out of the womb, to see labour and sorrow, that my days should be consumed with shame. Granted that the terms were very extreme, and I should imagine that Job's friends, if they sat down to analyse his words, would find in them something very offensive, as Jeremiah's friends might also have done. There was every excuse, humanly speaking, for the bitterness with which both these men viewed the condition in which they found themselves. One had been deprived of everything physically that seemed to make life worth living, external and in his own person. He had been described of everything spiritually it seemed to make it worthwhile living too, for his intimate friends had left him. Gathered around him was three men who had sat for a week's silence and were shortly to make his suffering only worse. And God seemed for a long time, as this discussion goes on, to be quite unapproachable to him. Jeremiah suffered similarly. He had his God near him still, no doubt, for many revelations came from God to him, some of them while he was in prison. Yet those revelations added only to his burden, because he was told of the impending woe and destruction of God's people and was invited to send by message smuggled out of prison, or in other ways, the message of the impending destruction of the nation of Judah, which could only, if the king and the princes took his word seriously, make his sufferings more grievous when they took their vengeance upon him. So in the case of both men, they were in desperate straits and were deprived of everything which it seemed could make life worth living. Before we sit too hardly in judgment on the way they expressed themselves, I wonder if it wouldn't be timely for us just to sit a little bit in judgment upon ourselves. I suppose there are in this room people of the placid temperament who take life as they find it. And there are people of a schooled spiritual temperament who have been taught by God to take life as he gives it to them. Not too many of the latter, I would imagine. That is quite hard to come by. And I should think there are in this room some, I know for sure of at least one, of more than one indeed, to whom the implicit assumption comes that life owes it to us to be pleasant. And that when, for any reason, things don't go as we would like them to go, then we have good reason to complain. It doesn't have to be a big matter, either. I suppose, in fact, that those who are the most grievously afflicted tend to be least extravagant in their complaints against Providence. It's the person whose aims in life are not very important, in any case, who wants to go out and it's raining, who had some plans in mind and the other person cancels the engagement, who wanted to achieve a certain type of success in life, and whether because of the folly of the examiners or their obvious partiality, or for whatever reason has not succeeded in passing the hurdle that was necessary before an evidently maladjusted world would let him continue. And when this kind of thing happens, there is instinct in every one of us the feeling that we are entitled to grumble, that we may look around with jaundiced eyes and find the hidden suspect motive that makes the world turn against us. It doesn't take a great deal of doing. The least thing to go wrong can make us bitter. Two things in a row can make us highly suspicious that this is a conspiracy. And three together can make us absolutely convinced that even Providence itself is against us. And we can almost go as far as that and use words and think thoughts which, if we carried them to their logical conclusion, would be tantamount to saying, God has set himself against me because I haven't got exactly what I wanted. Because three things in a row have happened as I didn't like it. This convinces me that the world is my enemy, and the world is God's world, and therefore I'm an outcast from the dealings of God. That is very rarely said. But that kind of thought is there. And I suppose there lies at the root of almost every grumble the recognition that to grumble is to say, this ought to have been otherwise. And to say this ought to have been otherwise is to say, somebody should have arranged it otherwise. And to go on from that is to say, and to somebody who didn't has not done his duty. And it's only because we generally close our mind at that point and don't say, and who was that somebody ultimately, that we stop short of the words of blasphemy. But the perilous train of thought is with us as soon as we start doing this. And as soon as this kind of grumbling takes possession of us, and we choose to be aggrieved at all there is around us because things are not as we would have them be, we are beginning the slippery road that could lead us to the point where any handy Job's wife might say, curse God and die. We ought to bear in mind, I think, I ought to bear in mind, this is a mutual exhortation, that my son despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loveth, he rebuketh and chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. Is a message which is given to us, not primarily so that I can quote it in an exhortation to you when things are going fairly well for me, and forget it when they're not going as well as I would like, nor are they yet primarily texts on which to write exhortations or Sunday mornings or counsels of advice to one another, but they're given us things to be remembered when it happens. I think there are most of us we'll find ourselves at one time or another in the position where, because things are going very well, we can read a message of Scripture which offers a rebuke to somebody who's complaining and see how it hits him. And who, when the difficulty arises and it smites ourselves, can forget that very message or invent some specious reason why it doesn't apply to us. And we have every right, we do well, as Balaam said to his ass, to complain. So, faced with the terrible sufferings that Job endured, and the almost insupportable afflictions that were heaped upon the head of this righteous and tender-spirited prophet Jeremiah, can we bear in mind, not only now, when we were after all under duty to be here, and it doesn't matter so very much, but this afternoon when it might rain, when we were wanting to do something else, or whenever it is that events turn against us, can we bear in mind that those words are intended for our admonition then? And that if we can learn to school ourselves to be cheerful in the face of the very slight disabilities which life occasionally crabs us with, then we shall be in a better position to meet the major ones when they come, and say when that kind of problem arises, the Lord giveth, and the Lord is taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In looking at this third chapter of Job, we are indeed struck by the extravagance of its language, and I don't personally think that it's very profitable to try to analyse the justification for and the significance of every suffering remark that was wrung out of Job or out of Jeremiah's lips by their anguish on this occasion. Words like, let the day perish where I was born, from Job. Or let the man who told my father that a son had just been born to him be like Sodom and Gomorrah, which the Lord overthrew and repented not. I don't think words like that benefit in any way by being carefully analysed as a combination of a logician and a chemical analyst might do, in an attempt to discover what precisely is the import of cursing a day which happened some 100 years ago, and what difference you can make to the day when now has arrived. I don't think it helps us at all to try to suppose that Jeremiah is really meaning, I would like to get back to the man who told my father some 40 years ago that my mother had given birth to a boy child and mother and child were both doing well. I would like to see that man destroyed with fire and brimstone as Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed. I doubt whether it's any advantage to us or any justice to Jeremiah or Job to try to see those words as being the calm utterances of people who were meaning the words that they spoke to be construed literally. I think it's far more profitable to us and far more just for them for us to imagine them saying simply something like this: the day that I was born has proved to be, as far as I can see, an unmitigated calamity. The person who went and told my father that a child was born didn't know what he was talking about. If he could have seen the future and seen me languishing as I am in prison, with nothing to make life worth living, then he would certainly not have been in such a big hurry to pass on the news. And I suppose if my parents had known that this was the kind of problem with which I would be afflicted when I grew to be a man, then they wouldn't have wanted to be parents. My father himself would perhaps have preferred to be childless, and my mother too. No good in my present situation has been achieved by that day, and unless this situation should be bettered, no good will have been achieved by it. That's the kind of thing, I think, which, put in rather almost insufferably prosaic terms, the beautifully poetic lamentation of both Job and Jeremiah should convey to our minds, and I think we would be wrong to carry it further. But it is quite an interesting thought, isn't it? We are short-sighted when a child is born. We do blink the possibilities of the future. When nurse answers the telephone and says to the anguished paternal parent, yes, it's a boy, or a girl. Mother and boy. I said boy first because I have boys. I said girl afterwards to be fair. We do blink facts, though, when we look upon the events of however long ago it was, and thinking only in terms of cribs and pink and blue and admiring looks and not even the sleepless nights or what the Americans call diapers, we congratulate the parents concerned on the blessings of the present and don't think of the possible and the actual disadvantages. The actual ones we do right to ignore. They are part of the taking in one's stride of the joy of having one to care for, the fruits of our own marriages. But the future is quite a problem, isn't it? There are innumerable parents who have rejoiced when the child was days and months and a few years old, who have, when the child was older still, had cause for sadness. And the sadness could have been of various kinds. It can have been the sadness of a child gone wrong, for not all the beautiful things in perambulators do go well in later life. It can have been the sadness of a child neglecting its opportunities of spiritual advancement. It can have been the sadness of a child cut off in prime or before prime by mortal sickness. It can have been, I suppose, the sadness of a yet surviving parent seeing her son in prison languishing for his faith, as Jeremiah did. I don't know whether Jeremiah's mother was alive at the time, I suppose not. But there have been mothers in those circumstances. And there are some rather dreadful pictures in the letter to the Hebrews, chapter 11, which seem to suggest that there were parents who needed to suffer in the affliction of their children whom they begat and bore. There was, wasn't there, one woman in particular, to whom it was said, when her child was but days old, yea, and a sword shall pierce through thine own soul also. and who later must stand by his cross and hear him say, "Woman, behold thy son." Son to John, behold thy mother. If we could see into the future as we undertake the adventures of life, including that of becoming parents, we might see that there are hazards in that future, that there are uncertainties in it, that there can be deep and terrible sadnesses with or without joys to come. And I suppose that it's not only Job, therefore, but also, as she were living, Job's mother and father. Nor yet Jeremiah, but also if they survived, Jeremiah's mother and father, who might look upon what was then happening and wonder if it had been worthwhile, as many of the parents of children killed in warfare have had cause to wonder, when the rolls of honour have been written up and the casualties counted. So when Job says, "Cursed be the day when I was born," he is in effect indulging in what is now a very, very painfully well-informed kind of hindsight. I'm going back to the day when I was born and saying, "And if this is to be the outcome, what is the purpose of all this?" He might well ask, even if he's not to be given the answer. I suppose Abraham might have asked the same question too. He waited until he was 99 years old before he received the clear promise that not only would he be the father, but Sarah the mother of the child that was to be born. When Isaac was born, he waited till he was a grown lad before the Lord said, "Take now thy son, thine only son, and offer him there for a burnt sacrifice." And Abraham, at the point where the knife was raised, and his son was to all appearances about to die, when all evident hope was to be dashed from him, when the clear denial, "This shall not be thine heir," spoken of Ishmael, barred the way so far as that son was concerned, and this knife shortly to be stained with blood was effectively to close the way, so far as the son of promise was concerned, I suppose that at that point, Abraham might very understandably have been saying to himself, "And so why was all this done? Why was this son born to Sarah and myself at all? Why have we come to this point only to dash again the hopes that were brought to life some 18 years ago, if that was the time?" Something of that kind of order of time, anyhow. It's a great mark of Abraham's faith that apparently, from all the records that we have, this is not the way he allowed himself to think. We don't know too much about Abraham's frame of mind when he was about to offer Isaac, but we do know from the book of Genesis that when Isaac asked about the sacrifice, Abraham said, "God will provide." And we do know from the letter to the Hebrews that he accounted that God was able to raise him from the dead, from whence also he received him in a figure. So it would appear that this man of faith proved his faith in his trials to such an extent that the offering of Isaac was a thing accepted in his heart in such a way that he could have done the deed and still not lost the faith, and known that resurrection would follow upon doing God's will, if things went so far. Really, I think Abraham helps us more as we think of him in connection with Job, not so much as a pattern of what Job's parents might have felt like had they known, as a pattern of Job himself. Things had not gone uniformly well for Abraham, but in this, with the solitary exception of this matter of childlessness, they'd not gone so badly since he left Ur of the Chaldees. As far as one can tell, he'd always been rich. He'd always been well provided for, despite his choice of the place other than the fruitful land where Lot determined to go, which was, relatively speaking, barren and inhospitable. His flocks and his herds were numerous, and his men servants considerable. He was rather like Job in many ways. And Abraham might very well have been such a person as would have permitted a possible Satan to say, "Well, Abraham's not serving God for naught. On the whole, he's doing very well out of it." And this would have been particularly true when the last obstacle was removed and the rejected Ishmael was replaced by the promised Isaac, and the desire of his and his wife's hearts had been realized. Everything seemed very rosy for Abraham's future at that point. It could very well, therefore, at that point have been said, "Doth Abraham serve God for naught? Behold, thou hast set an hedge about him. Thou hast granted him sheep and cattle and oxen and everything in abundance, and now a son to be the heir of the promises. What more could he want? Of course he serves. And this, take now thy son, thine only son, and offer him," was to make a different Abraham of that Abraham. Like that Job before his suffering. Nothing could properly have been raised against Abraham's character. He had gone out when he was called to go. He feared God. Insofar as Job was, so was Abraham, a man perfect and upright. But he was, with respect to the desire of his eyes, still a man untried. A man to whom Isaac, though he'd come late, had come, and if he kept him easily, could so readily have been taken for granted. When we ask about the trials that God inflicts upon people, we're apt to be short-sighted in another way, too. We may say, God knows from the end from the beginning, which he does. God knows whether a man tried with respect to his faith will respond favorably or unfavorably, which we do not deny. Therefore, such an expression as, God did tempt Abraham, represents that which was quite unnecessary. There was no need to do it, because he knew which way Abraham would go. And therefore such a test as, take his goods away from him, take his health away from him, was needless, because there was no need to convince the adversary, and there was no need to convince God, who knew everything from the beginning. Job, to the extent to which he didn't, wouldn't fall away, and Job, to the extent to which he did, would. And God knew it all, therefore why do it? But it's short-sighted, I say, because it disregards the fact that to leave Abraham alone because he isn't going to sin leaves Abraham the kind of Abraham he was. To put Abraham to the test and give him the opportunity of sinning so that he doesn't is to make Abraham the man who has rejected sin when it came to him, has been tempered by his submission to the evils presented before him, and has become a tried and a steeled and a tempered Abraham, which he wasn't before. And to put Job in the position, not of knowing that he wouldn't curse God if he did lose his goods, but proving that he hadn't when it happened, is to make of the Job who was restored at the end a very different Job from the Job as he was found at the beginning. You take the man of chapter 1 with so many thousand of this, and so many thousand of that, and so many hundreds of the other, and with his wife and his 10 children. And you compare him with the Job at the end, with twice as many thousands and hundreds of this and that and the other, and with 7 sons and 3 daughters. And you say, well, the only difference between Job A and Job B is the extra thousands of sheep and cattle and asses and oxen. And the answer is, that's not true. The real difference between the first Job and the second Job is that the first Job was the Job living a comfortable life, serving God and seeing no reason why he shouldn't. And the second Job was a Job, broadly speaking, coming through in his integrity and serving God when he might not have done. And in the other particular, recognizing the extent to which he had fallen from grace and admitting it, and having learnt something which he might not otherwise have learnt. So why does this happen to him? And above all, why should this happen to me, be it trivial as it usually is, or grave and important as it may be, should not be answered by God knows about this and he needn't have done it, but by God needs the kind of person who comes out of this, and therefore he did it, which applied to Abraham. And it applies to Job. Now, we've got rather a humdrum task in front of us now, and I don't think we can do any more than illustrate it, because this would be a long job. It was a long job for me. It would need it to be longer to have been done thoroughly, and it would be no less long for most of you if you did it thoroughly. But, well, there'll be some people in this room who've read the book of Job on and off for 10, 20, 30 and more years, usually around about Christmas time, as part of our regularly daily Bible reading programme. It comes, you will remember, just about the end of the year, in our first section of our Old Testament readings. And whether because we have so many other things to do at that time, or because this is the kind of book that tempts us to do this, I think most of us have read the book of Job, and we have said, those of us who thought about it at all, one of these days I must get down to an analysis of Job's speeches and see what he really does say and what he doesn't. One of these days I must get down to an analysis of all three speeches of Eliphaz, all three of Bildad, and the two of Zophar, and find out what they are accusing Job of and whether they are in any respect right in what they say about him and what their real policy was in saying it. And one of these days I will analyse the long speech of Elihu and will try to make up my mind once and for all between the conflicting opinions. Is this a bumptious young man who's no better than the other three but just thinks he is? Or is he a delegate sent from God who knows far more than they and is saying it well and has a real message for Job? And one of these days I will analyse those powerful, mighty speeches of God and try to see in what way they answer what Job is doing and arrive at a conclusion once and for all. Who have said this in Christmas 1920, 30, 40 or 50 or 60 early, something, and have kept on saying it year after year. This is a case where if we had to ask for a sort of general exodus of anybody who was guilty in this way, we would find John chapter 8 repeating itself and beginning at the eldest and going down until the youngest. There would be a large-scale parade of people out of the room. And had it been a month ago, I'd have been, well, a little bit to the front of the middle of the queue. But now, it's a little bit different. I will be able to linger behind, because I have in this book here, I have in this book here, 2, 4, 6, 8 pages of very close-spaced, extremely small type, attempting to summarise the speeches of Job and his friends. Now, I'm going to read you bits of this because I'd like you to see how you can improve on it, which I'm sure you will see at once. But also because I'd like you to see that this is the only way, really, to get down to what the actual speeches in the book of Job are about. One of these days we all have to get down to this kind of analysis if the detailed meaning of Job is going to be clear to us. And I'm sure we shall profit immensely from doing it, and I don't think there's any other way of doing it than that. However, before doing that, and just to give you time to take in the idea, let us once again address ourselves to supplication and to praise, singing Anthem 36. Anthem 36. The chairs are getting gradually more rapid in their settling down. It's interesting. The hymn book is about the noisiest thing we've got in the room at the moment, I think. Anyway, Anthem 36, Search Me, O God, and Know My Heart. So would you open your Bibles at the book of Job now, starting with chapter 3, and I will try out some of the praises which I've offered and see if you can see the main thought of this as an epitome of what the chapters are offering us. You have the scene clear, have you not? Job, sitting upon the ground, afflicted by his grievous afflictions, scraping himself with potsherds to control the itches. His three friends, who have sat silent around him for 7 days, now waiting for him to speak and then to give their answer. So, chapter 3, verse 1. Why was I ever born? It would have been far better for me if I had died in the womb. For then I should simply have slept with those who had died before me, untroubled by the wicked, unafflicted like the conscious, weary ones. Why must I stay alive to no profit? I long for death, and it is denied me. I can see no advantage in God sustaining me further in consciousness, to whom he denies the blessings of living. I have no peace, and even the peace of dying is withheld from me. A single connected thought: why was I born? Why can't I die? Chapter 4. The first speech of the first, perhaps the oldest and most important, he seems to be the leader, of Job's three friends. Eliphaz, speech 1, chapters 4 and 5. I know, Job, that it would be hard for you to listen, but duty compels me to speak. You have done much good to many other people, but when trouble strikes you, your faith fails you. Why do you not still trust in God, knowing that God has never allowed the innocent to perish? It is only the wicked who reap the consequences of their wickedness. It is they whom God strikes finally down. I have myself had a revelation from God, a vision from God that terrified me, telling me that no one whatever can be just in God's sight, that no one must exalt his righteousness above that of his Maker. Even the angels, I believe, are not faultless. How much less should men be? It is true that wickedness sometimes seems to prosper, but misfortune was suddenly overtaken. This is a common experience of the sons of men. The only right course, Job, is to put your confidence in God, who gives all the blessings that nature holds, and who also overcomes the devices of the crafty, even using their own guile to overcome them. For those who accept God's correction, there is blessedness, for his stroke is followed by healing. He will redeem you from all your troubles. You will be able to laugh at every threat. You will be restored to your prosperity, and you will die in peace in a good old age. Not an offensive speech, really. It contains much that we would have to accept as true. In the first place, Eliphaz begins by recognizing that Job has been a very good man. He recognizes in the early part of chapter 4 the good things which Job has done to help other people. And this is as it should be. Moreover, in looking at Job's affliction, although he drops a broad hint that long-standing affliction can only be the result of wickedness, he doesn't at present claim that Job is guilty of this wickedness, only that his continuing trust in God will determine whether he is or not. If he trusts in God, if he lets his confidence in God remain untarnished and unspoiled by the deep afflictions that were fallen upon him, then one day God, who has tried him, will restore him to favour. His latter end will be like his beginnings. He will die in a good old age, and everything will be splendid. And to that extent, Eliphaz proves himself to be a true prophet. He's right in what he says about Job. This does actually happen to Job. There's a hint here and there that, under suitable provocation, Eliphaz might go considerably worse than he's been thus far. You get it, for example, I suppose, in chapter 4, reading from verse 6. Is not thy fear of God thy confidence, and thy hope the integrity of thy ways? Remember, I pray thee, whoever perished being innocent, or where were the upright cut off? According as I have seen, they that plough iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. By the breath of God they perish, and by the blast of his anger are they consumed. Now, there's much in that that's true, too. Even the words of the New Testament, "Be not deceived, as a man soweth, so shall he also reap," contain the same kind of thought as Eliphaz has his offering here. And the word which he quotes in the course of this speech, he taketh the wise in their own craftiness, are actually quoted by Paul with commendation in 1 Corinthians chapter 3. So there is much that Eliphaz says here which is perfectly acceptable as sound teaching, but there's the shadow of worse things to come. Eliphaz is a little too confident of his own observations. He's a little too sure that what he doesn't know isn't knowledge. There's the suspicion that he's putting himself up as a judge who knows when God is merely chastening a man to give him blessing later, and when he is actually punishing him because he deserves it, with no blessing to come. Those words, "according as I have seen, they that plough iniquity and sow trouble reap the same, by the breath of God they perish," means I have been able to recognize some perfectly obviously wicked people, and I have seen what has happened to them, and I know therefore of my own knowledge that this was God's judgment. And there's always the possibility, as soon as a man starts talking like that, that one of these days you'll say, "And this has come upon you, Job, because you deserved it." Looking behind the facade, I've been able to see in you that which warrants this judgment of God. He hasn't said it yet. What he said yet is perfectly fair, but there is the suspicion that the fairness may forsake him. It looks actually as though Eliphaz must have been not only a man of some standing, but in some way I think of some standing in God's sight. It looks as though his claim to have received a vision from God is actually true. Chapter 4, verse 12. "Now a thing was secretly brought to me, and mine ear received a whisper thereof, in thoughts from the visions of the night, when deep sleep falleth upon men. Fear came upon me, and trembling, which made all my bones to shake. The hair of my flesh stood up. It stood still, but I could not discern the appearance thereof. A form was before mine eyes. There was a silence, and I heard a voice saying, Shall mortal man be more just than God? Shall a man be more pure than his Maker? Behold, he putteth no trust in his servants, and his angels he chargeth with folly. How much more them that dwell in houses of clay, whose foundation is in the dust, which are crushed before the moth? Betwixt morning and evening they are destroyed. They perish forever without any regarding it. Is not their tent cord plucked up within them?" Now we've got several difficulties there. We don't know quite which part Eliphaz regards as his vision and which part is his own commentary on the vision. Whether perhaps it was only verse 17 that was spoken to him in his dream, and he adds 18 to the rest on, or whether it was 17 to 18, which seems a little more likely, than he adds the rest. If that is so, then verse 18 doesn't really present us with the problems we might think, because "he putteth no trust in his servants" need not mean he doesn't accept his immortal servants as trustworthy. And "his angels he charges with folly" need not mean "and his immortal angels he charges with folly," because the word for angel is a malach, which is a messenger, and there are many human messengers as well as divine ones. And so it could simply be that Eliphaz has learnt from God that we are not to presume to be more righteous than God, to be more pure than the one who made us. We mustn't set our judgments against his. What I think, though, whatever is the breakdown of this vision between the revelation and his commentary, what I think Eliphaz failed to recognize, both here and in his words, "he taketh the wise in his own craftiness," is that he should have applied them to himself, as well as to Job. That vision which Eliphaz received, he seems to have been regarded as intended for Job's admonition. It could also have been intended for his own. The statement that mortal man shall not be more just than God could very well have been a warning. And so don't set up yourself in judgment when no judgment has been pronounced by the Creator himself. And if this had been heeded in that way, he might well have advised Job to take notice of it, but he might, in what follows later, have taken better notice of it himself. Still, that was Eliphaz's first speech. In chapter 6 and 7, we come to what is Job's second speech, but in effect, Job's first reply. So, in chapter 6 and 7, Job, continuing his complaint, devotes himself at least in part to replying to Eliphaz, and we'll try the precy again. I wish that someone would try to understand what my sufferings are like. If I speak extremely, it is because I am smitten with the very terrors of God. Even my food is uneatable, so great are my sufferings. All I ask of God is that he should put me out of his mouth of my misery. If I could see this in prospect, I should rejoice in my very anguish. I haven't disputed God's judgments, but I can hardly be expected to bear these afflictions as though I were made of stone and they didn't hurt. It would be good if my friends would show me some pity in my suffering. But instead, for the most part, they disappear like the ice of winter when the sun begins to shine. You are a little better. If your own vision, Eliphaz, of the night frightens you, you can't be of much help to me when I'm frightened. I have not asked you for succor in my poverty, or help in my affliction. I didn't ask for alms or a restoration of the goods I've lost. If you were to help me at all, you would help me better by showing me, by demonstrating to me what sin I have committed. For otherwise your wisdom about sin and its rewards proves nothing. You are treating me as though I were but an object in the marketplace of your debatings. You don't seem to realize that here I am writhing in anguish. All you can do is offer philosophies. Let me tell you, therefore, categorically, that I do deny that I have any guilt at all that can explain why these things have come upon me. The second chapter of this reply. We all live the earth like wage earners waiting for our payment. And I, in my anguish, wait only for death as the reward of my patience. But the days speed by without hope, and all I have to expect is some ultimate far-off oblivion. There's no escape from the grave when it comes. Why do I have to be hedged about with banks as though I were the sea, and would flood if I were loosed? Why must I be bound and confined as though I were some monster of the deep, which would run amok if it was released? It were better for me to die than to be tormented, and I cannot conceive why God should occupy his time as though it were important to him to afflict a man. Does it really matter that he should wreak his vengeance or his ways upon one so small and little as a mere man, like me? Even if I did sin, which I have denied, does this do God any harm? Can he not wipe out the sin and then forgive? Very soon I will be dead, and then it will make no difference to him. It will all be over for him as well as for me. It's very human reasoning, of course. But it's the afflicted man's reasoning. This is Job in his anguish, wondering what it is all about, why it is so important to God to bring about affliction, why he can't let even a sinner die in peace. And if there is a reason to answer Job, it's a very natural complaint of one in the depths of his affliction, and it deserves sympathy. It wasn't a righteous speech. It wasn't an altogether right speech. But it was not, as we reckon guilt, so very much a guilty speech that we would be able to sit in judgment on him. God, perhaps, but not you and me. But it's Bildad's turn. And Bildad is notable for his brevity. He's much shorter than the others. In his third speech, very short indeed, though I suspect there's another reason for that. However, Bildad's first speech, chapter 8 of Job. Job, how can you possibly suppose that God is unjust in doing what he does? If he has done this because of the sin of your children, then he should appeal to God on their behalf. And if you were upright, God would not fail to listen to you and grant you renewed and enlarged blessings. If you would learn from the men of old, for our experience is all too short, you would know that it is those who forget God who perish like the river flagged, deprived of water, while the other herbs remain green. This is not the way in which God treats perfect men. If you were like them, he would fill your mouth with rejoicing, and the wicked who distress you would be punished in your place. Where Eliphaz tentatively led, Bildad blunderingly followed. Where Eliphaz dropped a delicate but painful hint, Bildad plunged in. "You've got wicked children," he said. Well, perhaps he had, I don't know. Careless and light-hearted ones they seem to have been. Then he should intercede unto God on their behalf, as if Job had done everything else the morning after the night before, every time they'd had a feast, where Job had sanctified them in case they had cursed God in their hearts. "If you were upright, God would not fail to listen to you, Job. So, well, draw your own conclusions," is hinted at in Bildad's words. If you'd read your records, if you'd seen the history of ways of old, you would have seen that wicked men perish, while others are like the grass that doesn't need their surroundings and stays alive. You'd be like the grass that stayed green, Job, if you were perfect. And the only answer I know to the syllogism which begins, "If a man is perfect, he is not afflicted, you have been afflicted," is to draw the conclusion, "Therefore you are not perfect." And though Bildad doesn't precisely say that, there is no doubt at all where he stands. To that, Job must now reply. And chapters 9 and 10 are devoted to what is Job's third speech, his reply to Bildad's first. No doubt you're right about the righteousness of God, but how is it possible for any man to be righteous in God's sight? Moreover, how is it possible for anyone afflicted to vindicate himself before God, who needn't listen if he doesn't want, and can crush any inquiry which he regards as being rebellious? You've got to get the ear of the Almighty before you can say anything to him, and how do you set about doing that? You need only to think of his overwhelming might in the earth and in the heavens. How should he listen to me? I can't even discover him as he passes by, still less stop him in his purposes. I can't imagine that God would really attend to me if I did call him. If it did happen, I would hardly believe it. But in any case, the evidence of my own conscience is all the other way. God torments me for no reason. No reason that I can see. I cannot match his strength with mine. I cannot take him to court to plead against him. And if such a thing were possible, then in his presence I know my very righteousness would crumble and be worm-eaten and corrupted. But I know I have not sinned to deserve this, and though I die for it, I will maintain it. It's quite clear to me that God destroys both righteous and wicked men alike. In the earth itself, too, after the pattern of God's dealings, there is no justice. Day after day I spend in misery, and my life draws unprofitably nearer to its close. And if I were to take heart and look for deliverance because of my innocence, God would see to it that the old reproach clung to me and wouldn't let me go. There isn't even any conceivable middleman who, being acceptable in God's presence and visible to me, could bring us together. Oh, that there were such a day's man! If only God would let me for a while be free from this visitation, then I would be able to present my case before him without fear. But I see no hope of this. All the same, my despair is so great, and so utterly lost in desperation, that I will presume to plead with God if he will let me. I will at least use the words and ask him to explain why he afflicts me. I will ask him now, "God, why do you play into the hands of wicked men by oppressing one who's done nothing to deserve it? Can it possibly be, God, that you look with the faulty eyes that men have, like Eliphaz and Bildad here? Can it possibly be, God, that you imagine sin, as they are beginning to do, where there isn't any? You know it is not so, God. I am your creature in any case. Whatever I'm like, you made me so. And I've not been false to the way I was made. In good conscience before God, I can claim that if I have sinned, I would deserve punishment. And yet, once again, I'm full of fear that even though I were righteous, there's nothing I can do about it. Any pride on my part would only bring down further wrath from God. But I can't understand in this case why I was ever allowed to be born. Once again, if this is the end of it, why did it start? It would have been better to be stillborn. And now, God, will you please let me alone and let me die in peace? It doesn't go a lot further, perhaps. There isn't much further that Job can go. Except in a frame of mind which is gradually drawing nearer to the right one, though through a painful lapse, as the discussions proceed. Job is there afflicted, and he hasn't committed the kind of sin that would, humanly speaking, have warranted it. Job is in the position of that man born blind, who, when the disciples asked, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind, was vindicated to this extent by Jesus, that Jesus said, neither this man did sin, nor his parents, that he was born blind, but that the glory of God might be made manifest. There is no local and immediate cause for this man's affliction, and there wasn't in Job's behavior any local and immediate cause either. So what could he do when his friends persisted in beginning to insinuate that there was, but say, it's not so, before God it's not so, and if only I could speak to him instead of to you, we might get a bit further. And now Zophar takes up the tale. Job chapter 11. Zophar's speech. This man Job has got to be taken in hand. For he prates and he boasts and he mocks. He claims purity. But if only he could see God's mind, he would know that he suffers less than his iniquity deserves. It is impossible by human seeking to discern the nature of God, who is higher, deeper, longer, and broader than we can conceive. No one can hinder God's judgments, and no one can avoid them. No one can hide his iniquity from God's gaze. So all that Job must do is to admit his fault and purify his heart. And then God will remove his trouble so that it be remembered no more. And full happiness and glory shall return to him. But his wickedness will remove all hope if he repents not. They're rather faithful disciples of Eliphaz, these two men, aren't they? Eliphaz begins by saying, God doesn't do things which are iniquitous. God won't permanently punish the man who doesn't deserve it. God will restore from his affliction the man whom he's only trying, but God will punish permanently those whom he really is punishing. And so, Job, well, as it were, as a gentle hint, make sure you belong to the being purged class and not to the being punished class. But Bildad offers three legs of a syllogism and leads us only to the end. And Zophar says, Job, you're a very bad lot. And you ought to know it and admit it. The right course with you is to do as they are sometimes said to do on the thither side of the Iron Curtain, and keep you in your prison of contempt until you sign a confession, even if you didn't do it. That's the way, Job, to get you to recognize your sin. And so, Job, there'll be no hope for you unless you do confess. Zophar has gone where Bildad has led, where Eliphaz has pointed. And has accused Job of the definite sin of which he is charged. There's something about Zophar's speech I just want to comment. Verse 8 of chapter 11, starting at verse 7. Canst thou by searching find out God? Canst thou find out the Almighty unto perfection? It is high as heaven. What canst thou do? Deeper than Sheol. What canst thou know? The measure thereof is longer than the earth, and broader than the sea. We have sometimes quoted with approval those words, canst thou by searching find out God? The answer is no, not by one's own searching, not merely by researching, unguided by God's own revelation? The answer is certainly no. But Zophar's wisdom is merely saying God is unsearchable. It requires a later age, a fuller knowledge, and a deeper understanding of the ways of God to be able to take, as I think Paul is taking, the words of Zophar and give them a much fuller and fresher and deeper meaning when he writes in Ephesians chapter 3. Ephesians chapter 3, verse 14. For this cause I bow my knees unto the Father, of whom every family in heaven and on earth is named, according to the riches of his glory, that ye may be strengthened with power through his Spirit in the inward man, that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith. To the end that ye, being rooted and grounded in love, may be strong to apprehend, may know, because you have been taught, what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know the love of Christ which passeth knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. Now unto him that is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that worketh in us, unto him be the glory in the church and in Christ Jesus unto all generations for ever and ever. Amen. Zophar tells what a man recognizes as a barrier that can't be passed. Paul discloses what the Spirit of God reveals as a barrier which has been passed by the ways of Christ, opened up to us. It is high, deep, long, and broad. But it can be found by the man of faith. And Job found it before Zophar did, and had to tell him about it later. So Job replies to Zophar. Job's fourth speech, his reply to Zophar's first. Three chapters of it, though rather short ones, chapters 12, 13 and 14. You think yourselves very wise, don't you? But I'm your equal. You are mocking me, and God ignores me. Meanwhile, wicked persons are doing well. Everyone knows that God is the author of all that is. You have only to let creation talk to you to know that. This is nothing new. Of course he is wise, and no one and nothing can resist his purpose. That we can take for granted. He is even able to make wise men behave like fools. Remember that, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar? He is able to take away the understanding of the elders. He can set up nations and destroy them. He can make the mighty ones grope in darkness. I'm just as well informed about that as you are, and would like to discuss with God directly rather than with you. For you simply invent lies to explain my problem. You would be wiser to be quiet. You are really toadying to God. Because he is great, you attribute sin to me, which you can't prove, so as to please him. Do you not realize that God himself knows what you are up to, and will one day rebuke you for it? Your protestations of wisdom are the arid pronouncements of barren sages. My situation is different. I have to wait for God to answer. But even on pain of death, I will not lie myself into admission of guilt I do not feel. Only let God withdraw his hand from me, and I will answer for myself, or hear God's charges against me. It can surely not be that he is visiting upon me sins of a long past youth. We are all short-lived and full of trouble. Is it really so important to God to inflict people like me? We inherit the qualities of our race. We can hardly be blamed if we have faults. We can't do much harm in our lifetime either, so why not let us rest in peace until we die? There is hope of a tree. If you cut it down, it will sprout again. Or if you didn't happen to want it there, there's fear of a tree that if you cut it down, it will sprout again. But once cut a man down and there's nothing else to be expected from him, he's gone, he won't sprout up again, so why not let him die like a dried up lake or river? He'll never awaken again to cause any further trouble. Why can't I be allowed to rest in the piece of shell for a while, if it were possible? Just for a while, perhaps, until God's wrath has passed. I wonder if such a thing is possible. If I were to die, might I live again? I would wait for it gladly, and then God might rejoice in calling me forth to know his will. But meanwhile, my mysterious, my undisclosed, my secret so-called sin continues to dog me. You will wear me out as surely as erosion wears out mountains and stones. For even these cannot resist the activity of God. Always you conquer man in the end in death, and still, with myself as the example, keep him in torment while he lives. It's a fitting rebuke for the wise men. You're not so wise as you think you are. A little bit of back chat, perhaps, but very understandable from somebody who's being impossibly provoked. It's a fitting acceptance of the impossibility of getting close to God. It does begin to wonder whether perhaps it may be in a life beyond the grave that the answer to this is to be found. But still it says, I want to reason my case with God. I'd like to tell him how I feel about it. And the first round is over. And the second round of speeches begins, and Eliphaz takes up the tale again. Chapter 15, Eliphaz Part 2. Your wisdom, Job, has escaped you, and all you utter is vanity. You have lost your fear of God. Your very speaking is moved by sin. You speak as though there were no wisdom for you to look back to in the ancients. Yet we are possessed of very much older men than you, Job, or even your father. Why don't you listen to us and stop your heart rebelling? I've already told you. From the vision I had, you remember I had a vision from God. I've already told you that God trusts no creature of his, not even the heavenly ones. And he will certainly not be well disposed to mere men, especially when they make iniquity their meat and drink, like you, Job. Let me tell you some ancient wisdom. Wickedness is accompanied by perpetual suffering. The wicked loses his property and is driven to hunger because of his rebellion against God. He is, in fact, just like you, Job, in what happens to him. So take the obvious lesson. Eliphaz pointed, Bildad led, Zophar followed, and in the relay, Eliphaz runs and catches up. Job is definitely guilty. He's done all these things. His punishment is going to be perpetual, and he's deserved the lot. And so Job has to reply to that, too. Chapters 16 and 17. You are just going over the same ground again and again, and you call yourselves comforters. I could do the same for you, were our positions reversed. But I wouldn't. I would give you some real comfort. But now that God has afflicted me, you all come and make sport of me. God has stricken me like a host of enemies. I'm full of tears. I'm dressed in sackcloth. And still, with heaven and earth as witness, I know I have not deserved it. The grave must surely be near. But my comforters are in league with one another to denounce me and my sorrow. One day this will be put right and the righteous take heart again. But meanwhile you behave like fools all around me. All that is left for me is the quiet and the rest of the grave. When it comes, they go round and round, he goes round and round. There's not really much else that can be done at this point, now that they have got to the point of accusing him, save to deny that he deserves the accusation. But Bildad takes offence. Chapter 18. Now Job is using his words to lash his friends. It is as though because he is suffering, the whole universe must be incommoded. On the contrary, it is the wicked one himself who will suffer in darkness, with snares to take him in his own counsel to trap him. In fact, he will suffer just as Job is suffering now. And ultimately, his remembrance will be blotted out, and his children extinguished. Bildad has rather a propensity for twisting the knife in the wound. Have you noticed that? Job, you've lost your children. They must have been a very bad lot, and it's all your fault. Job, you are a wicked person. There's no hope for you, and your children either. Not a very nice man, Bildad, but very sure of himself. Job replies to Bildad. Chapter 19. Your reproaches are endless. It seems to me as though there have already been 10 of them. Actually, there had 5 speeches, but, yes, plenty of reproaches in those, 10 or more perhaps. Even if it were true that I have sinned, this is a matter between me and God. But if you must meddle, I shall have to tell you, God has overthrown me in my cause. He has closed his ears to my wrongs. He has utterly ruined me in person, in glory, in friendships, even in the love of my wife. I could wish that all my sorrows were inscribed in a book, engraved in the rock and filled with lead to be permanent. For my vindicator does live, and one day I will see him for myself in spite of all my present sufferings. And when that happens, there will be judgment for you too. So beware. Very capable of hitting back, Job is, but still, God has overthrown me in my cause. Sounds like a very dangerous statement. God has perverted judgment. Seems to lie in those words. And Zophar thought so too. Chapter 20. I am driven to speak again by the shock I feel at your impious words. Do you not know that the wicked only triumphs for an instant, that he will vanish as a dream? Though he rejoiced in his sin and its rewards, it will all be taken from him. He will not be able to enjoy what he has heaped up. The very pleasures will be snatched from his mouth. Heaven and earth will rise up against him. By way of saying, that's what does happen and what has happened. This is the reason for your suffering, Job. And Job replies again. Chapter 21. Suspend your mocking for a moment and listen to me. Do I not have some reason to complain? If what you all say, and you in particular so far, is true, why are there so many well-off, prosperous, wicked persons around? You know there are, with well-favoured children, goodly herds, splendid music in their homes. It's true that the grave takes them, and I would not wish to emulate their ways, but you know that some who die have lived a full life before they do so, and others die in bitterness. You say that it's the wicked man who is bound to reap calamity in this life, do you? Then look at those who are borne to their graves in honour, with men walking in their train, paying them tribute, and yet they've been the wickedest upon the earth. Your very premises are utterly untenable. You're not looking facts in the face. They weren't, were they? There are people like that. There are plenty of wicked people who do go in human honour to their graves and are the subject of high-sounding obituaries when they die. Job was perfectly right in his complaints, even if he was not right in seeming to heap scorn upon God's judgments. And now Eliphaz has his third and last try. Is it possible for man to do God any service? This is chapter 22. If you are as good as you say, it brings no advantage to him. Your only reason for any judgment you may have is to avoid his judgment. Any goodness you may have is to avoid his judgments. In fact, though, your so-called goodness is a sham. You have kept your brother's pledges. You have withheld help from the needy. You have disregarded the cries of widows. You have oppressed parentless children. This is why you are troubled, Job, and you deceived yourself into thinking that God cannot see what you have done. Even the examples of old, men who have gone the same way and suffered for it, seems to leave you entirely unmoved. So, Job, put yourself right in God's eyes now and get peace. He will build you up again if you do, and everything will be secure and prosperous. Eliphaz isn't without his kinder side. Even now he would like to see Job repent, but for a man who's rather addicted to visions, he isn't quite as self-critical as he ought to be. He was given a vision about how God regards his servants and didn't take it the right way. But now a man who began by warning Job that his sufferings would be permanent if he had sinned, now goes on to say, look, Job, this is what you've done. First, You have lent a pittance of money to a poor man and slept on his pledge, which the law forbids. Then, you've seen the needy crying, you haven't let him glean or even given him any help. Third, you've seen widows without husbands to look after them, and you've turned a deaf ear to their pleas. Fourth, you've oppressed the orphans when there was nobody to care for them, and it was all, as we say in our modern language, fabricated out of whole cloth. There wasn't the slightest bit of evidence for what I had said. He'd imagined all that, driven to it by the inexorable logic which says people aren't afflicted like this without having deserved it. It's only people who deserve it who are afflicted like this. Therefore, Job is a person who deserved it. What kind of things might a man do to deserve it? Well, let's see. He's a rich man, so he could have lent money. And he might have kept the pledge and demanded usury. He's a rich man, so he could have helped the poor, but he didn't. He's a rich man, so he could have regarded the widows and the orphans. In fact, Eliphaz is drawing a rather understandable piece of quite unsupported interest from the knowledge of what it lay within Job's power to do by way of goodness. And it was all wrong. Job had done all these things, but for the logic of Eliphaz's position, he mustn't have done. So history had to be rewritten, and facts had to be ignored, and a new history put in its place. So Job replies to Eliphaz for the last time, chapters 23 and 24. If only a man could find God and discuss with him, surely he would hear me without quenching me. But I have looked everywhere, and he will not be found. I have kept his ways fully, but he's afflicted me nonetheless. It is not that I deceived myself and he cannot see me. It is that he has put the darkness over me so that I cannot see him. There are many who do the evils you mention, and worse. It seems that God disregards them, and regards only myself who don't do it. Even the murderers do their deeds with impunity. It's true, certainly, that the grave is the end of them, but in the meanwhile, they live a comfortable enough life. Disprove this if you can. And just to finish the dialogues as far as we can go, Bildad's third speech. I feel almost sorry for Bildad here. I don't think we'll use a paraphrase here, or even a precis. We'll use Bildad's own words in chapter 25. I think we need to make this sound very portentous. Then answered Bildad the Shuhite and said, Dominion and fear are with him. He maketh peace in his high places. Is there any number of his armies? And upon whom doth not his light arise? How then can man be just with God? And how can he be clean that is born of a woman? Behold, even the moon hath no brightness, and the stars are not pure in his sight. How much less man that is a worm, and the son of man, which is a worm. I tried to make that sound unctuous. I think it must have done. I tried to make it sound like the pretentious sermonizing of a man who has nothing more to say, but insists on saying it. It seemed to me that here we have the portentous, deliberate, high-sounding words of man who feels that he's saying very important things. And the best he can do is slightly to exaggerate and make rather silly something that Eliphaz has said before him. Eliphaz said, the messengers of God are not pure. He doesn't trust his servants. And so Bildad tries to improve it and says, actually, the moon's a bit dirty, and God would rather like to spring clean the stars. It is an awful lot of nonsense, really, that Bildad speaks, and it seems to me that people have rather fallen short of an understanding of why Bildad's speech is so short. I think it's so short because if we were printing this chapter in a modern way, we would follow the word worm in verse 6, not by an exclamation mark, but by six dots. And we would picture Job in his utter exasperation butting in. For the first time, politeness fails. And this man decides that we can't have any more of this. And Job puts Bildad and the rest of them in their place. Well, Job's next speech is a long one. It leads immediately to Elihu's. It forms a more or less natural break in our discussion, and I think we shall have to leave it to the remaining addresses available tomorrow to sum up the message of the book. So that's all for this moment.